From Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, this is East Central Europe, Past and Present. I'm Holly Case of the History Department at Cornell, and this blog series brings you perspectives on the past, present, and future of East Central and Southeastern Europe and how scholars have approached it. The following interview with Laszlo Karsoly, professor of history at Szeged University in Hungary, was conducted in Budapest on January 10, 2016. Karsoly specializes in the history of the Holocaust and anti-Semitism in Hungary, and he's also written on the nationality question in France and on the Gypsy Holocaust in Hungary.
So I'd like to start with sort of biographical stuff. Your father, Elek Karsoly, was also a famous historian. Could you talk a bit about what it was like growing up with him? So what sort of historical knowledge and perspectives did he impart, like, in the context of the family?
Yes, my father was born in 1922 and survived the Holocaust in Budapest, hiding in an empty villa on the Buda side. His mother was killed in Auschwitz, so I never met my paternal grandmother. And till 1983, I never dared to deal with this topic as the Holocaust. And my father was, as you mentioned, a well-known historian and Holocaust historian in Hungary, but he was almost alone. When he started to publish historical books and documentary books about the Holocaust, it was in 1957, just after the so-called 56 revolution, and he was the first to publish documentary books. He never wrote about the Holocaust, and at home he never spoke about the Holocaust. I learned a lot about his experiences and how the relatives perished during the Holocaust from my mother. But they divorced. So I was raised by my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, and her second husband, Laszlo Harsh, who was a writer and also a Holocaust survivor. Mm-hmm. My mother and my grandmother, her mother, was not Jewish. So I am, according to the Nuremberg laws, half Jew, and my mother told me a lot about the experiences, the sufferings of my father. But at 1983, my father asked me what is my plan, what I want to do as a historian. I published till that time two small books about minority questions in France and in Belgium, and I was without any idea. I had no idea at that time what to do, and he proposed me to deal with the Gypsy Holocaust, the Hungarian Gypsy Holocaust, and at that time I began to go to archives, and so I can tell you that I inherited the topic of the Holocaust, and in 3 years later, in 1996, He died. He was relatively young, 64 years old. Once in my life, when my elder son Daniel was around 8 years old, he asked my father, "Grandpa, what did you do during the Second World War?" And to respond to my son, he told a lot of very interesting things. And a few years ago, I wrote all these stories in the Élet és Irodalom, the liberal weekly magazine, with the same title, Grandpa, What Did You Do During the Second World War?
Mm-hmm. So did you record them at the time?
No.
You just overheard them?
This was during the excursion. We went to the hills, and my father liked very much Daniel. He's now a lawyer, already 38 years old. But it was 30 years ago when he dared to ask his grandfather. I never asked him during this was only 3 years since 83 till 86. We worked together on the Holocaust. When he went to the hospital where he died, he worked on the Szálasi trial, the People's Court protocols, huge volumes of documentation, and he wanted to publish editing and he wanted to publish the whole trial papers. And we discussed a lot about the People's Court, a lot about leftism, about the Marxism. My PhD dissertation was about the Marx and Engels, about the nationality question. And when he read my dissertation, the manuscript, he gave my manuscript to the editor of the Magyar Filozófiai Szemle, a Hungarian Philosophical Forum, and one of the editors of this prestigious journal asked me to come to his flat, and we discussed more than 3 hours about my manuscript. Mm-hmm. I was at that time already, it was around 78, 79, a strong anti-communist, anti-Marxist, right-wing dissident, I can tell you. And at the end of our discussion, in my paper, in my manuscript, I attacked Marx and Engels in several topics, but the publisher told me that, in quoted Voltaire, that I don't agree with you in any words, but I defend your right to publish. And it was 79, it was a very brave action from his part, and my paper was published in the Magyar Filozófiai Szemle, and I was a little bit scared what will happen, but nothing happened. This is not a political forum, and my father was convinced that I will lose my job if I continue to behave as a dissident at the Szeged University, where I began to teach at 75. But our common work was only for 3 years. Since 83 till 86, and about the Gypsy Holocaust, we discussed a lot. It was a very interesting thing. And after his death, I published the Szálasi, the protocols of the Szálasi trial, but under his name and my name. So this was a common book, and last year was published our next common joint book. This is the Indictment Against the Nazism. He published three documentary volumes in 57, 59 and 64 about the persecution of the Hungarian Jews in 1944. Since the occupation of Hungary in March 1944 till the Eurocross takeover in October 15. And from October 15 till the liberation of Budapest, this is the Eurocross rule in Budapest, and he began to collect documents about the Eurocross Jewish policy, and I finished almost 30 years after his death, but I published on the net only this document, huge documentary book, more than 1,300 pages, documents with footnotes, with a long 76 pages long foreword. So I don't know if this was an answer to your question.
I'd like to ask a follow-up on that front, because you talked about your where you ended up in your own political trajectory in the 1980s, that you were already anti-communist, and you know, you categorized yourself as sort of being on the right of the dissident spectrum at the time. Could you talk a bit about your father's own trajectory politically and how that meshed with your own?
He was a left-wing thinker. In the early 40s, he was in the rabbinical seminar. He was a rabbi. He finished the rabbinical seminar, and in 1945 he was asked to go to New York to become an aide of the chief rabbi of New York. I asked him sometimes why he chose to remain here in Hungary. I could be the chief rabbi of New York or maybe Chicago, in case he went, but he decided otherwise. After the Second World War, he became Social Democrat and then a member of the Communist Party. In 1949, he lost his job as an archivist, as a teacher at the university, now at Eötvös Loránd University. He was a sociologist. And his chair, Professor Sándor Szalai, Szalai Sándor, a famous sociologist in the 60s and 70s, was arrested and became one of the vádlott.
Was accused.
One of the accused of the a smaller trial than the Reich trial, but he spent maybe 4 or 6 or 5 years in prison, Sándor Szalai. And then my father he was forced to become archivist in the National Archives. And in 56 for 5 years, he didn't become again a member of the Communist Party, because in the new there was a Communist Party named Magyar Dolgozó Pártja, the Party of the Hungarian Workers, And after the 56 revolution, the new party, the new name was Magyar Szocialista Munkáspárt, Hungarian Socialist Workers Party, and everybody had to apply again. Who was already before 56 a member, it was relatively easy to become a member, but in 58, 59, 60, it became harder and harder to become again, or became first time in the life, her or his life, a member. In 61, my father became again a party member, and already in the end of 60s and the early 70s, when I became my studies at the university, our political dispute became harder and tougher almost every year. I gave him once a birthday present, an example of the illegal samizdat, Hungarian samizdat, the beszélő. And in the beszélő I wrote some words that to I give you this beszélő to help you better understand my political views. He understood me very well, but he was very afraid that I had that time already my wife, two children, a decent job at the University of Szeged, and he knew very well that he cannot defend me in case the things that I teach at the university, for distributing the vessel at the end of the 80s, I already wrote two articles in the vessel. This was my last act as a dissident, in a few months the communist system collapsed. Not because I wrote two articles in the Beszélő, but I became enough tough, enough hard, enough brave, only at the end of the 80s.
What were the articles on?
The first articles was this was a review about Krauss, Tamás Krauss and László Béládi, the short biography. The title was The Short Biographies from the History of Bolshevism. They published a book and I wrote a very harsh critic about this. They were very confident that finally they reveal that Trotsky wasn't an American spy. But because Trotsky sometimes was against Lenin, he was, according to Béládi and Krauss, a bad communist. But Lenin was a good communist, Stalin was a bad one, and I criticized both Lenin and Stalin and Trotsky. So, and the second one was about some political issue, not historical, but political issue about Eurocommunism or something else. So we were in constant quarrel, constant dispute, and even he tried to convince my wife to retain me, to appease me, and I several times during last couple of years I remember in the early days of May 1986, and he was already in hospital. Once I asked him, he was very, very scared, and he thought that he will be killed by the physicians. It was a minor operation, and he died as he he was convinced that he will be killed by the physicians, and I asked him jokingly that no, this is the last days of your life. What do you think about your life? And he responded very seriously that my son, believe me, that we wanted a better and good world, but I don't know that this we can, but I have to quote him because he was a very decent man. He never cursed, he never raised his voice in our presence, he never beat us as we were children. But in the hospital, answering to my question, he began slowly and he was very, very sad, and he said, we wanted in 1945 good things. We wanted to create, to build a new world, a better world, but we fucked. Whole thing. Elbasztuk. And I think the same thing now in Hungary. So we wanted a new, a better world instead of the communism, and we arrived to this same. I arrived the same conviction that we elrontani.
Ruined.
We ruined.
So I mean, one of the implications of what he said is that it was he was implicated in its ruination, that we did it, that we somehow are responsible in some way, shape, or form for what happened.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of what he felt to be his own responsibility in that? I mean, what was there any kind of attempt to suggest where they went wrong, what went wrong?
During our conversations and our disputes, he was a, what was his position? He was an archivist in the National Archives. He never accepted and never was raised for a department director. So he remained a humble archivist. And then came 1972, when he was 50 years old, and he published with a colleague a book, a documentary book about the 1944-1945. The Hungarian title was Sors forduló. Mm-hmm. When the fate turns, when the occupation of the German occupation, the Soviet occupation, and this was a documentary book, how the liberation of Hungary happened, what the ordinary people saw, what the ordinary people survived. And this book caused a big scandal, political scandal. The Czechoslovak embassy in Budapest, some people at the Czechoslovak embassy were charged to survey the Hungarian cultural life. And they indicted my father and his colleague in Moscow. And from Moscow came the order to punish my father, to publish documents about the behavior of the Soviet, the Red Army. And my father got party punishment, last warning before expelling. Utolsó figyelmeztetés, kizárás előtt. Last warning, And my father was shocked that he published only documents. He wasn't an anti-communist, and he got this very severe punishment. And in a few months, he was called by a high-ranking communist cultural leader in the cultural life, and he was nominated director of the archives of the trade unions. And from 1973, he was a director. This was during the last 12 years of his life, he was a director. This was not an important post. He published a lot of historical books about the Horthy regime, about the foreign policy of the Horthy regime. He was an angry and sad man because he never got official recognition from the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. He never became an academician. His position and his role in the to building and to create this new world was very, very small. But he felt that this is his regime. This regime defended him and the other Jews from anti-Semitism and anti-Semites. He never dared to criticize the Soviet Union. But when his book from the Berchtesgadeni Sasfészek től a Berlini Bunkerig, this was the title, from the Berchtesgaden Eagle's Nest till the Bunker of Berlin, is a very good title for a Second World War book, and it was translated into Russian, and he got a very generous honorarium, and he went for 2 weeks. He was invited to Moscow and then to Yalta, and but when he came back, he was so shocked by the anti-Semitism, the official anti-Semitism at that time in the Soviet Union, in the late 60s or the early years of the 70s. But he was very sad, but never criticized openly. Openly it means never criticized in family the Soviet Union.
So I'd like to go back to this matter of sociology. You said your father was a sociologist. It seems to me as though, at the time anyway, sociology was a catch-all discipline for intellectuals of high ambition. Is this correct? I mean, for people who are trying to think in bigger ways about society and about the world of ideas. And secondly, what was your father's own path to sociology? I mean, because he became a historian, and I think there are other people, you know, people like Jan Gross, for example, who started out in sociology and became historians. What is it about sociology in Central Eastern Europe that makes it special?
Yeah, it was a good story in our family because after 56, my mother became one of the best friend of one of the wives of the former chair of my father, Sándor Szalai. Sándor Szalai had around six or five wives, and I don't know who was Kati Szalai, who and. I know a lot of stories about the relationship between my father and Szalai, my mother, who was a young student at the same department at the university at the end of the 40s. And at that time, it was a very young discipline in Hungary, and it was some kind of suspicious to deal with this discipline. And when Sándor Szalai was arrested, my father asked for reason, and he went to one of the leaders of the university, who told him that I know the name József Szigeti, and this person told him that this discipline as sociology doesn't exist, because which is science in sociology is in the writings in books of Marx and Engels. Everything outside the writings of Marx and Engels doesn't exist. But the first person who, after 56, went to an international congress of sociologues was József Szigeti. He was the head of the Hungarian delegation, as he was a very clever, wise man, spoke fluently German, English, and other languages. And even I heard a story about him, József Szigeti, and another Hungarian well-known intellectual, István Király, who was a professor of literature and wrote excellent books about, for example, about Endre Ady. And these two guys, as young students, it was in 1942 or 1943, Szigeti and Király was fellows in Berlin. 1942, 1943 in Berlin, two Hungarian students, and they spoke about who will win the Second World War. And I don't know which said the gave the final answer, or the Germans or the Russians will win. But one thing is sure: we will professors at the university after the war. So Szigeti and Király became professors, and my father lost every interest to this discipline. He had to become archivist, and in the archives he slowly he began to learn how to become a serious historian. His first social book, not book, it was a small, not too small, around 100 pages long study about the children workers in the great Hungarian firms, Gyermekmunka gyáriparban. And once when he asked me to go to the cellar and bring a lot of brick and a few coal. I asked him that it's not enough from the children workers, and we want to be liberated and so on, but he compelled us to work for the family heating. But he lost every interest after this experience. When the Department of Sociology was dissolved, the head was arrested, and my father, as I mentioned, became jobless, and he was very, very afraid. I think he spent his adult life in constant fear. Fear from the regime, fear from the enemies of the regime, far from his son. He was very, very happy when my brother, György Garsai, began his university studies, and he became a Greek, Latin, and Sanskrit student, and not a historian. So...
We've talked a lot about your father, and you know it's a big theme in Hungarian culture, especially for that post-war generation of fathers, because so many of them were absent. You know, like the István Szabó film, and this sense that even the fathers who are there are not all there in a way that they could be known. But it strikes me that we've also, in an ancillary way, talked a fair bit about your mother, from whom you got the story of your father, and also who, as someone who was befriended, who befriended Szálai, or who knew these people, and who was a contact former between a lot of the intellectuals that were in that circle, that she was an important figure, and also she was non-Jewish. And so could you talk a bit about your mother and her role in your kind of intellectual upbringing and what kind of influence she had on your thinking?
Yeah, but I have to begin with my grandmothers. I mentioned the real paternal grandmother killed in Auschwitz, but after the Second World War, or at the end of the Second World War, my father met with Emma Lederer. Emma Lederer was an eminent historian, a Jew, a survivor of the Holocaust. They met not in the ghetto, but they spent a few days when my father was arrested by the Arrow Cross and sent to the ghetto. Both remained totally alone after the Second World War. Emma Lederer was a historian of the medieval age in Hungary, and then became a professor at the University of Elte. And I was raised by two grandmothers. One I was lost in Auschwitz, but Emma Lederer as the mother of my father, and Judith Sziráky, the mother of my mother. And Judith Sziráky was a writer, a writer, and he was a member, an eminent member of the so-called second generation of the prestigious journal Nyugat. Mm-hmm. She published excellent novels about her birthplace. It's Máramarosziget, Felső Visó, and these places. Hajnali Madár, Bird of the Dawn, and this is a collection of the novels, and she knew personally such persons as Kosztolányi Dezső, Karinti Frigyes, and Móricz Zsigmond, and other persons who are in the textbooks of high school textbooks. For me, they were familiar names, because she told me a lot of personal stories, and they had a huge library at home. And she and my mother gave me a lot of books to read, and they teach me and they counseled me what to read, what to think. And second husband of my grandmother, László Hárs, was a social democrat. But he and he was a journalist and poet at the same time, and friend of Attila József. And László Hárs was expelled from the Népszava, the Social Democrat daily magazine, where he was for a short time one of the editors of the cultural section of the Népszava. And when I began to think about the political life, I always asked for advice, not for my father, not even my mother, who also scared a bit, but from my grandfather. And once I remember very well, I wrote some kind of at the university. I wrote some kind of small paper for a professor, and I gave my short 2-page or 3-page long something to my. I called him also grandfather, because the real grandfather, the first husband of Judith Sziráky, was Antonio Vidmár. Antonio Vidmár was a fascist diplomat in Budapest. So when the Jobbik will create the new government, I will declare that I am from a fascist diplomat who praised Mussolini in the Hungarian press. I found a lot of articles from Antonio Vidmár, who was a very good friend of Babich. And Babich was one of the
witnesses.
One of the witnesses at the marriage of my grandmother. So Babich and Antonio Vidmár was very good friends, and at the marriages Babich was a witness. And when Babich and Vidmár got a very great award from Mussolini for the translation of the Tragedy of Man of Madács into Italian and Divina Commedia into Hungarian. This was the work of Babich and Antonio Vidmár, and both got a great medal from great award from Mussolini. And in Rome, when they got this, I don't know what, both raised their arms for a fascist salute. And László Hárs, as a young journalist in the Népszava, very severely criticized Babich why to raise a fascist salute to Mussolini. And László Hárs became the second husband of my grandmother. So my family stories are endless. This story I was told not by László Hárs, not by Sziráky, but my mother. My mother's second husband was Aaron Tóbiás. Aaron Tóbiás was a young journalist in the Hungarian radio, who was one of the last persons who gave radio reports from the parliament in 56. Wow. And he was arrested after the 56 revolution, and in 64, 65, I was at that time 15, 16 years young. He told me a lot of stories about, real stories about the revolution. So this was a very interesting intellectual life and very interesting family. And
I'll say, I mean, it raises all kinds of other questions, and it's hard to think of, you know, which direction to choose, because one of them is on the one hand, you know, to mention István Szabó again, who talks about fathers first, and then later he talks about generations of Jews. Yeah. And in the film about generations of Jews in Sunshine, it seems as though it's the men who are sort of thrown into politics, and the women who, because they can't or because they'd rather not, they're sort of outside of politics. But it seems as though your grandmother and your mother both, in one way or another, were you know, either were actively in or were thrown into political life. And to what extent did they consider themselves agents in choosing their own political directions, you know, in their choice of spouses and, you know?
My grandmother, Judith Sziraki, was... maybe she even didn't know that, but she was a very liberal. She had never official job. She was only a housewife and a writer. She published very few, maybe 500 pages long, her whole literature. Producing, but what she published is a one huge volume of novels. Once I remember very well when I joked with her and I told her, "Why, Grandma? Why you?" She was called. She was such a beautiful lady. She was called by the elders Cleopatra, and I called her only Cleo. Why Cleo? You criticize always the communists. They want good things, and they want to make us happier, and they want to that our life could be better. And my grandmother responded, "Listen, Lotzi, I would like only one thing. They leave us in peace. I don't want to give us good or bad. Leave us in peace." Word by word, they don't want to be so good with us. Jót se akarjanak nekünk tenni. So my mother, since 67, became a dramaturg in the Hungarian television. At that time, it was a very prestigious work. He translated into Hungarian, synchronized the foreign films into Hungarian, subtitles or word by word from French, from Italian, and English. When she got this job, it was in January 67, and her first travel abroad was in May the same year, 67, to Cannes. And she traveled a lot. She went to Cannes with a delegation of the Hungarian television to buy films. So she was very, very well received by the filmmakers, by the producers and others. And she traveled a lot to Italy, to France, to England and other places. She spoke fluently German also, if I remember correctly. And she was very happy. She was free to travel. She had a lot of salary at that time. And even she was very brave because in the early 70s or in the 70s, I asked her to buy for me books, but these books were evidently forbidden in Hungary. She never refused my request. And For example, Edward Halley Carr, History of the Soviet Revolution, all the 11 volumes she bought, not once, but every once a year, in a year, she traveled 6 or 7 or maybe more time to abroad, and every time she bought one volume of the...
Excuse me, this begs another question. So you actually read all 11 volumes?
Of yeah.
I remember something now, taking the class with you when you, on totalitarian leaders, it was on dictators, yep. I think. And you talked about having read the complete works of Stalin, I think it was, or
not
Lenin.
Stalin, not, but Lenin, all the books of Lenin since... January 1917 till last 7 years of Lenin, but all the books of Marx and Engels, around 80 volumes. This all 11 volume of Carr is not a big deal. I read a lot of Stalin, evidently, but only in Hungarian. And the Lenin is much less than the Marx and Engels because it was only 20 volumes from 1970 January 1970 till his death is not too much. But I followed the order or the advice of Trotsky, because Trotsky said once that who wants to become a real Leninist must read Lenin from January 70s till his death. This is the real Lenin, not the Lenin who criticized him in the early 90s.
Sorry. Not too much to read.
So one of the elephants in the room that we've kind of skirted is the 1956 revolution. It's been sort of there in our conversation, but not right at the center. And I'm wondering if you can talk about your father's trajectory, your own relationship to it as an event, because it seems as though it's sort of pre-formative for the, you said that, you know, it was in the background when 1968 happened, and your father experienced it one way or another, but you haven't talked about that, or how your other relatives, you know, the people who raised you, experienced it and what they were thinking at the time, what they considered to be the fallout of it. Could you speak a bit about that?
The 56 revolution was a taboo in our family, except the second husband of my mother. Never my grandmother mentioned Judith Sirachi, never my father mentioned. Once my mother told me that my father at the beginning didn't want to understand what happened on the streets, and the revolution began on the 23rd of October, and my mother participated on the first great manifestations. At that time she was a high school teacher at Eötvös, maybe Eötvös High School. She was a teacher, history teacher, a very good teacher, and she went home and told a lot to my father what happened in Budapest, in the downtown. And next morning, 24 of October, my mother saw with an astonishment that my father got up very early and went to the bathroom. What are you doing? I have to go to Eger or something else, to countryside, for my work as an archivist. you will not go to Eger, told him my mother. Why? Because there are general strike, there are revolution, and so on. My father didn't want to believe and began to call his friends in the early morning. And everybody told him that really this is a revolution. And finally my father also got the point and understood what happened on the streets. But he was very disappointed after the destruction of the revolution, and his protest was that he began to deal with the Holocaust, to publish documentary books, with the financial help of the Clems Conference against Germany. So from outside money and with the collaboration of the Hungarian Jewish congregation. And for 5 years he refused to become a member of the party. But he silenced himself as a politician. So he remained a humble archivist in the National Archives. He never got an award or a premium or something else. Even his monthly salary was very, very low because he was a celebrity in Hungary because he published, he had a regular transmission in the Hungarian radio. First, he almost every week or twice a month he had the history lessons in the radio, and when he wrote this short 10 or 15 minutes long lectures, he read aloud in the radio, and then from these short speeches he collected a volume, and he quoted a lot of documents, and it was very interesting, and he was very popular. Then he became a member of different TV different TV programs. So he was a very well-known figure, but a silent and, as I told you already, he was always afraid. So the 56th revolution wasn't a topic in my family, and I remember that it was already in the late 80s or the early 90s when I first heard that my maternal grandmother and her second husband, László Hás, were among the Hungarian writers who in 57, 58, I don't know exactly when, a huge number of Hungarian writers signed a petition asking the United Nations not to deal every year, was one section, every year at October, I don't know exactly, in New York, in the United Nations plenary session, discussed the Hungarian situation. Mm-hmm. And 200 Hungarian writers protested against this imperialist, anti-communist, and so on action, and among these 200 Hungarian writers were my grand parents, and I was very saddened and disappointed. So I never learned, I never read about the 56th revolution till the 1980. It was in 1980 when I got a fellowship to Paris, and at that time in Paris, Rue Alésia. It was a Hungarian guy who had a huge apartment, and every walls were covered by anti-communist and other literature in different languages, and it was free. Everybody who knew his address and phone number could go to his flat and to bring a lot of books, and I dared to collect dozens of books, small and big ones, Orwell's Catalonia and 1984 and Trotsky and Deutscher and other books, and someone asked me in Paris that what are you doing, what will happen at the border if you will notice to carry these heavy bags with full of anti-communist books. And I responded that I will not lose my job, I hope, but I know that if on the border the border police will confiscate these books, they will bring this to the library of Széchenyi. And at the library of Széchenyi there was a secret section, a titkos, zárt, closed section. And there are a lot of other people who had the permission to go to the Széchenyi. I thought that maybe I can contribute with my books. It was free, so I went back, and I remember that when I arrived to Budapest from Paris, I was stopped evidently by a határőr,
border guard,
and he asked me to open my big bag, and I opened, and the first book was Orwell Catalonia, and he took the book, it was in French, I guess, and he asked me, why do you have so many books? Because I am a professor of history at Szeged University. Okay, have a good day. And he closed. Brought back to Hungary the book of Mérei, Tisztító Vihar, cleansing storm about the history of the 56th revolution, and I told to several people that I have this book in Hungarian, and I got a lot of phone calls. Do you have the book? Not the Bible, but the book. Never mentioned by phone, the title or the writers of the book, Mirei, and I don't know who is the second person. When I got the dozen of phone calls, I responded, okay, my father-in-law, the father of my wife, will be the first to read it. The second will be my father, and so on. But everybody had only 24 hours. It was a very long book. So during the next couple of days, the people, my friends, relatives and other people, they became very, very tired because during 24 hours they could read, but without sleeping an hour. It was a very moving experience for me that everybody was so happy to read finally something about 56 and real good. Some years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, I had the chance to meet Mirei, and I told him this story. That due to his book, a lot of people didn't sleep for days in Budapest. So at the university, I never spoke about the 56 revolution in the 70s and the 80s. I always stopped teaching and criticizing the so-called Soviet regime in 53. The death of Stalin, till the death of Stalin, I never ventured about other topics. It was largely enough, and sometimes I arrived at the final point to be fired from the university in 84. I gave lectures to high school professors. 2 hours I spoke about the high school textbooks, what is in it, what is not in the textbooks, and what is wrong in the high school textbooks. And even I read the whole text of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 39. And I was accused of anti-communist propaganda and so on. Some of the professors fell ill and indicted.
They charged
me and the secret police, and they created a small committee, and Daniel Csatári and 2 other of my colleagues, the members, and they told me that there is 6 points in this investigation. Why did you tell that the teachers teach lies following the textbooks and so on? And I just tried to respond the questions. Even it was one of the questions was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. And I wrote the questions and I answered questions, and I quoted, which is the 6th question? There's only 5. Mm-hmm. And that's not important. The first 5 was important, the 6th one. I asked the leader of the committee to tell me which is the 6th point in this accusation. He read the text was in the 6th point was that the American imperialist collected the Nazi documents and published the Nazi documents, and I quoted these Nazi documents. The American imperialist collected the Nazi documents, and I quoted the Nazi documents during my lecture, and I added to the yes. In spite of the fact that this was the cruel anti-communist American imperialist who published the Nazi-Soviet relationship book, this was the Foreign Department in 1948, the first collection of documentation of the relationship of Nazi Germany and Soviet Union between 39 and 41. Mm-hmm. This is a small volume. It was in English, and I got the advice to read it from my father. Based on this book, I gave my lecture at the university. But I criticized only Hitler and Stalin, mm-hmm. but not Khrushchev or Brezhnev or other people.
So maybe now, you know, at last, we can turn to the issue of Holocaust history, mm-hmm. which we haven't actually talked about. Because a lot of things that we have been discussing have, in an ancillary way, touched on the problem or the issue of what history is good for,
yeah.
and what it's used for by different people. And I wanted to ask you, first of all, you know, is there a difference that you see between what you wanted history to do and what your father wanted history to do, or what your mother, because she was also a historian, for that matter, you know, what they thought history was for? Or is it a different, is it a difference in kind rather than in mission, that the message should
yeah.
be?
Evidently, there is a big difference. When my father published his books and articles, when he gave lectures in the radio or in the TV, there was a cruel censorship in Hungary. Not only official censorship, but there was a more dangerous censorship, censorship of in their own mind. Sometimes he didn't dare to publish something, didn't write down some things, because he was afraid that it is too dangerous. So I can understand that he never wrote a history of the Hungarian Holocaust. He published only documents. He wrote about the Horthy regime, but within the frame of the official political life, I cannot explain better. When I began to deal with the Holocaust, I was already free. My first book about the Gypsy Holocaust was published in 1993. So at that time, my one and only aim was to write down what happened and why happened with the Gypsies in Hungary between the two World Wars and during the Second World War. And I was very surprised when one of my colleagues who wrote the foreword to my work wrote that I am a very brave historian, because I dared to criticize and to demolish some ancient beliefs and convictions about the number of the victims of the Hungarian Gypsy Holocaust. Before my publication, my book was published. The number of victims were around 20 or 30 thousand, and I claim my final result was around the victim. The number of killed gypsies was around 1 or 5 thousand, and the persecuted of gypsies is around 10 thousand. After the collapse of communism, the official memory policy of the right-wing politicians and writers and even some historians is to deny the responsibility of the Hungarian authorities, and even some sections of the Hungarian population. And again, my firmest conviction, my main aim is to fiat justitia pereat mundus. So I will write always what happened, why happened, and without any restrictions, any censorship. I don't want to write a good Holocaust history who can please to the right-wing persons or the left-wing persons, to the Jews or not Jews. Some 20 years ago we organized an exhibition in Budapest, and during the preparation of this exhibition, one of the leaders of the Jewish congregation in a huge meeting told us that he is not a historian, but he wants only one thing, that the number of the victims of the Hungarian Holocaust must be 600,000, because this is a sent number for us. And everybody was silent in the room, and I raised my arm that I am a historian and I know only sent calls, but not numbers. So the numbers will be 100,000 less, and if you don't agree, you can leave the room. so the number were not 600,000. So yes, I am against everybody sometimes, and I am for the truth, and I think that we have now the history, and the history of the Holocaust is constantly in the political life. So when we have to fight against an occupation memorial in the Szabadság Square, or against a plan to have a statue Bálint Hóman, notorious anti-Semite, pro-Nazi and pro-Eurocross historian, I cannot be neutral. To be a, maybe in case I could be a historian of the medieval age, but for the right wing, for the Jobbik Magyarország, the history is a tool. They want to redefine the Hungarian history, to create a new Hungarian generation which is proud of their history. I don't want to use history as a tool to form a new generation. I want to write down what happened and why happened, and without any other consideration.
Do you have time or any more, or do you have to go?
I was asked to go. If you have any important question, I can.
Well, there's one more that I want to return to from the beginning, because you mentioned that your father answered that one question seriously. We wanted to do a good thing and we messed it up. We fucked it up, basically. Yeah. And you said something about your own generation, or perhaps your own self, that I also wanted something good out of the transition, yeah, and we fucked it up. Mm. And I was wondering if you could talk, because, you know, the implication of that is that somehow some kind of decisions were made that implicates those who wanted something better in what happened. I mean, is that the case? Do you consider certain things to have been a mistake, or was it a matter of not realizing the power of certain forces, or?
It's a very difficult question. Yesterday, one of my best friends invited me to watch the Real Madrid soccer football game, and we did discuss the same topic, and we had no real answer for this. Maybe Hungary is condemned to live under some kind of dictatorship. We had no experience of democracy. We had very strong feelings in the population. The majority of the Hungarians is content. They like the actual regime. János Kádár 30 years ago was among the most popular leaders of Hungary. Ferenc József, after crushing the 48-49 revolution, became one of the fathers of Hungary. So maybe our new father is Orbán, maybe for 20 years. The liberal forces are very weak, the democratic forces are very weak. The situation is very grave and, I guess, hopeless. So we have a law about the sponsoring the parties. And every election campaign, some journalists try to count how much money the different parties spent for the election campaign. And I don't know the exact numbers, but if one party has a right to spend 1 billion of Hungarian forints, they spend 5 billions. And everybody knows this, and nothing happened. Nobody wants to change the basic law, and we, the ordinary Hungarian and electors, we know exactly that this is the electoral mafia who gives the extra money to the parties for extra jobs and extra contracts and extra. And this law is some kind of cancer. The corruption in Hungary this is a very, very big problem. The overwhelming majority of the Hungarians are convinced that the Hungarian political life, economical life is corrupted from the foot to the bottom, and nobody bothers with this. So
it seems as though, I mean, if one is looking for a sin of liberal democracy, it might be seen as neoliberalism, the attachment of a kind of particularly inescapable marketization of a very particular sort that got attached to liberal democracy, yeah, and that got, you know, lampooned from both the left and the right.
Yeah.
But it seems as though, under the current circumstances at least, and this is quite recent, I think, that somehow liberal democracy and neoliberalism have been separated again, at least in the minds of its critics, and namely through the migrant and refugee crisis.
Yeah.
Because the neoliberal critique is gone from that narrative. It's basically an attack on liberal democracy minus neoliberalism, whereas I think earlier Orbán was taking on neoliberalism.
Yeah.
His illiberal democracy was partly a critique of neoliberalism. And so what does it mean? I mean, if A, is this true? And B, what does it mean if now liberal democracy stands with, or is seen minus neoliberalism? Is that good because that marriage was such a catastrophe? Or is it bad because now people are being critical not of the true problem, but they're being critical of, like you said, people who want to do something nice for other people, and there's a schadenfreude that those people are getting hurt?
Yes, I think that the liberal democracy is a good thing. The famous Churchill saying that the democracy is the worst form of state, but nobody invented a better one. So if not democracy and not liberal democracy, the other forms already we knew a lot of other forms of not liberal, illiberal, anti-liberal, not democracy. Maybe this is, I was told recently by an eminent, eminent historian, academician, that the great empires sometimes collapse. And maybe this European Union is a great empire who will collapse. Not due to the migrant crisis or it was too early to accept as full right members these East European countries. But if you look the situation in 1990 in the newly liberated East European countries from Poland to Bulgaria, there was a lot of hopes, a lot of fears, and I remember that we hope that this will be much, much better with the help of democracy. Some cynic expert said already in the early 90s that the majority of the population of East European countries wanted the level of life of Western Europe, but wanted to work as much as in the previous, during the previous regime. This is not a bad idea to have a salary of a Cambridge professor, but I work as a lazy East European professor. But for a worker or other people, the dilemma is much simpler. They don't bother with the democracy or anti-democracy. They want only higher salaries, less work, and to let them in peace. Mm-hmm. So without a popular support, we Democrats, we lost the faith in the popular forces and lost the faith in ourselves. So no hope, no chance, and but I remember another thing. In the late 80s, nobody thought that in a few years the Soviet Union will collapse. Nobody. I was told by an eminent dissident philosopher that in the early 90s organized a huge 3 days conference somewhere in Vienna or Berlin, I don't know, about the Kremlinology. Mm-hmm. What the Kremlinologue saw before the collapse of the communism, what they előrelát
what they foresaw.
And I asked curiously at 3 days conference, a lot of lectures, and what was the outcome of this 3 days conference? It was one word: nothing.
3 days, well, could be worse.
Yeah.
So one last question, if I may, and that's about, because I think that recently there's been another change, possibly as a result of the migrant and refugee crisis, and that is in relation to the way that Jews relate to the current regime, to liberal democracy, etc. And here I'm thinking of the way that Jörg Konrad and Imre Kertész reacted to the migrant and refugee crisis, whereas critically they had been very critical of Orbán, particularly because he, you know, he has...
Oh, Kertész not.
Well, a bit, though, because he had been, you know, he skated very close to anti-Semitism within the party.
Yeah.
He had been critical of Fidesz, let's say.
Yeah.
And Konrad, definitely.
Yeah.
And then there's a kind of a more of a reversal for Konrad and a direct attack on liberalism in the case of Kertész. And is this, how can one explain this? Is this, I mean, is it a real opportunity for, you know, the Jews, the Hungarian Jews who have been consistently left out in the cold to finally come in from the cold and, you know, to finally be Hungarian in a way that the right is not fixated on their particular presence or absence and to be part of a Hungarian polity?
Yeah.
Or is there something else at play?
No, I don't think so, because in case the Hungarian... There is not such a thing that Hungarian Jewry.
Right.
There are a lot of factions and almost everybody is different from the others. Some intellectuals, and as Jörg Konrad and others, are in... present day with the Hungarian government anti-migrant, anti-Muslim stance, but not Jörg Konrad criticizes the anti-liberal policy in general of Orbán, but he supports his policy against the migrants. I think the main problem of the Hungarian Jewry is twofold. One is the problem of the Holocaust. The right wing never forget themselves that the Holocaust happened. The Holocaust happened to the Jews, with the Jews, against the Jews. And the Hungarian Jews never could forget what happened to them before and during the Second World War. The second is the Jewish role, the Jewish participation in the communist regime. And in the right wing concept of history, the Jews can be blamed for everything wrong that happened to the Hungarians, from the First World War loss through Trianon and Second World War loss for the communism and everything. So we Hungarian Jews are the scapegoats, a lot of Hungarian Jews participated in the communist regime, this is true, and a lot of Jews, sometimes the same people, participated in the 56th revolution. And again, the Jews were overrepresented in the dissident movement. And in the Alliance of the Free Democrats was called by their enemies already in 89 and 90 as a Jewish party, as the Fidesz was called Jidesz, the Jewish Fidesz. So now they became the Hungarian party. So I think in this specific topic, the majority of the Hungarian population is against the admission more migrants or any Muslim migrants. I think that György Konrád, in this specific case, maybe he has right. Christian Ungvári, who wrote already an article about this topic. Christian is one of my best friend. Several times we write together articles. I haven't wrote article and I never spoke about this topic in public. This is the first time, in case you publish this interview or part of this interview. I am convinced that Europe cannot... I am convinced, I know positively that during the last 60 years the majority of the migrants from East and North Africa and from other side, specifically the Muslim minorities, were not absorbed, not integrated, not assimilated. This is not a success story, and I don't want to use harsher words. And to add to this not integrated and not assimilated and intolerant minority, new hundreds of thousands of intolerant Muslims, this is more than a sin, this is a mistake. So I am liberal, I am Democrat, I am a lot of other things, that in this case I have to admit that I cannot accept the way and the means and the tools what Orbán used during this crisis, used during this crisis. But I have to admit that I don't want to have thousands and ten thousands Muslims in Hungary, mm-hmm. or in Europe.
Okay, well, I think we've exhausted all possible themes now.
Okay, thank you.